This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating, and today we'll be talking to Eric Baldwin and Tyler McNabb, authors of Classical Theism and Buddhism, Connecting Metaphysical and Ethical Systems, published by Bloomsbury Academic Press in 2022. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, Eric and Tyler.
Hey, thank you. Nice to be here.
Great. Glad to have you here. Let's just dive in. Your book argues that classical theism and Buddhism, or at least some Buddhisms on some interpretations, are philosophically compatible. But this is a pretty surprising claim, given some of the metaphysical commitments that most Buddhist philosophers hold. So we'll dive into your arguments soon, but maybe first, top line, can you explain why you think this is an important claim to defend? What motivated you to write this book?
Eric, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. The primary motivation, I suppose, is a bit of an extension of what we were working on in our Plantingian religious epistemology in World Religions book. That was my primary interest, and as a way to further some of the things we've been working on.
Yeah, so we have a volume with Lexington that is basically kind of comparative religious epistemology, and to see to what extent these other religious traditions can make use of Plantinga's religious epistemology. For those unfamiliar with Plantinga, he's a philosopher and a really important philosopher in the 20th, 21st century. And he argues that religious belief can be properly basic. That's to say rational apart from any sort of argument. And there's this kind of objection to Plantinga's epistemology where it's like, well, maybe all sorts of different religious views, even really diverse religious views, can make sense of Plantinga's epistemology. And so in the book, we're like, well, hey, we take a very kind of standard Nagarjuna interpretation of the Mahayana tradition, and we look at other various traditions of different religious traditions and argue that, hey, you know what? These religious traditions, it doesn't seem like they can make use of Plantinga's epistemology. Maybe if you adjust them a little bit, then maybe you could. And so this book really was saying, okay, wait a minute. Maybe we were too fast in that book. Maybe in this book, what we're going to do is we're going to look at and see like to what extent maybe a Buddhist can really be a theist and then thus make sense of Plantinga's epistemology. Because that's the idea, is that you need some sort of theism or something like theism to make sense of Plantinga's epistemology. So let's go ahead and see. And so I was giving a lecture to my comparative philosophy class, and I was talking about Buddhism and the impermanence and interdependence thesis and emptiness. And at the same time, I was just reading, like getting really big into kind of the classical Thomist literature, where not to spoil too much, but to where God is specifically not identified as a thing, or as an object, or as an entity, right? And I was like, wait a minute. Technically, there could be some consistency here, depending on how we apply the impermanence and interdependence theses. And so, yeah. Then I was like, Eric, let's write this book, and we wrote it. So that's roughly the history.
That sounds great. And so you've anticipated a little bit of my second question. So maybe, Eric, you can fill in here too, about what got you interested in the relationship between classical theism and Buddhism.
Well, I guess part of it goes back to my dissertation, in which I was trying to argue for a solution to what I call the problem of fully informed reasonable disagreement. How can you be fully aware of the reasons for believing some thesis, say, about ultimate reality, that it's empty of being or that it is full of being, and be reasonable in that disagreement? That is, you know, you've got in our book, you got John and Paul, right? John's the Zen Buddhist and Paul's the Thomistic theist. And they're both fully aware of the reasons that the other will provide in favor of their views, but they disagree about the truth value of those views, and yet they're both fully reasonable. You know, that's kind of mysterious. How does that happen? You know, and so I basically argue in my dissertation and elsewhere that in what makes one reasonable is that you're a member of a particular tradition of inquiry that has certain commitments to basic sources of evidence or justification. And that your reasoning in accordance with those standards is what makes you reasonable. And that reasonability is, say, multiply instantiable. You can be fully reasonable with respect to tradition Y, fully reasonable with respect to tradition Z, let's say, even though you disagree. So that, to me, was in the background of, again, my dissertation and then the book, the Plantingian Religious Epistemology book. And again, to further what Tyler was saying, it's like you've got philosophers who think being is ultimate reality, and you got philosophers who deny that very thing. How can you make those fit well together? And so, again, that was my personal motivation for getting on board in this project. How can we articulate in greater detail that sort of thing is indeed possible and maybe even actual?
Great. So let's dive into the arguments here then. Maybe we can start by identifying the metaphysical doctrines of these two traditions that you're taking on. And of course, they're big. So what do you mean by classical theism? And what do you mean by Buddhism? You've mentioned Nagarjuna, for instance, and now Zen Buddhism. So maybe help our listeners out a little bit. What's classical theism? What's Buddhism on your understanding?
Yeah, so I guess I'll go first. And then Eric, if you want to just follow up and pick up all the items that I missed. So by classical theism, we don't mean a sort of theism that is endorsed by a lot of contemporary analytic philosophers, right? So if you would read Alvin Plantinga, or if you were to read Richard Swinburne, they would look at God as a person like you and I are persons. They would look at God, it's just a difference in degree, rather than a difference in kind, right? When it comes to God and us. And yeah, he doesn't have a body, but, you know, still fundamentally he's a person. He has got properties, you know, power and knowledge and goodness that we predicate to him. And these are all distinct from each other, which is all still distinct from, you know, his existence, whether or not you want to consider that a property. So God is fundamentally kind of like us, is anthropomorphic in some sense, we're wanting to deny that. We think that God is actually not in time. They do. So God is wholly immutable, not just like he doesn't change in accordance to his like goodness, but like he's wholly immutable. He's impassible. We can't cause change in God. We can't cause God to suffer. He's simple, what philosophers, the medievals would call metaphysically simple. That's to say he's not made up of any parts. All the different properties that I mentioned earlier aren't really properties. They're shorthand descriptions of saying the same thing, namely that God is. God is the sheer act of existence itself. And so that's what we mean by classical theism, this kind of view where God is not a thing, and we exist, but in some different sense from existence itself, when we participate and find our grounding and being in existence itself. And by Buddhism, here I take, we look at Jay Garfield's Engaging Buddhism, and at the beginning of that book, he kind of gives almost like a little summary of kind of the fundamentals of Buddhism. And so we take the most metaphysical theses from this, impermanence, interdependence, which of course leads to emptiness. And we take that to be kind of like what's central here to the metaphysics of Buddhism. And so impermanence, by that I mean that subtle change entails change simpliciter, change within the substance. So it's no longer the same substance we're talking about, right? The identity is not kept, that it changes from moment to moment. By interdependence theses, I mean that all things are ultimately conceptually and causally dependent on other things for its existence, for its being. So things don't keep identity, right? They change from moment to moment, and ultimately those things that change from moment to moment are all conceptually and causally linked to other things, and there is no substance, so to speak. There is no inherent nature of a thing. We think that there is, we act like there is, but truly, given interdependence and impermanence, all things are truly empty.
So I'm curious then, you mentioned Nagarjuna, and you talked about Zen Buddhism, and some other philosophers come up throughout the course of the book. How did you decide which Buddhist philosophers you're going to engage with? Are you primarily taking your lead from Garfield? What brought you there?
So we look at, I think, Eric, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, we look at kind of philosophers that have kind of meant the most to us in our studies. So, for example, Burton and Westerhoff and Garfield were really big for me. Eric, do you want to say the philosophers that that you wanted to engage with?
Yeah, so I'm more familiar with the Kyoto school of Zen Buddhist philosophers, Nishida, Abe, and folks like that. And one of my advisors at Purdue, Donald Mitchell, that was his region. I took a few classes from him. So that's primarily what I was bringing to the table.
Great. So what I thought we could do is we can kind of move through the book in sequence, because your argument builds in that way. So we're not going to be able to hit sort of all of the highlights of the book, but we'll do what we can in the time that we have. So chapter one, now that we've got Buddhism and classical theism defined, we can understand the title, Can a Buddhist Be a Classical Theist? And if I understand you correctly, one of the main arguments that you put forward is that what you call FMD, the fundamental metaphysical doctrines of Buddhism, applies only to things, in the sense of things that bear properties. And since God, as you've just said, is not a thing that doesn't bear properties, he's in a sense excluded from this doctrine. And so that in that way, you can have consistency between FMD and classical theism. First of all, have I gotten that right? And second, can you maybe unpack that reasoning a little bit?
Eric, do you want to go?
Yeah, I that seems right. Another way to put it would be to put it more in the directly into the Nagarjuna tradition is that all phenomena are empty of own being. And by we take thing to be synonymous with phenomena or object, that all those terms are basically trying to get to the same notion that all things are interdependent, i.e. Lack own being. And then the next move would be, well, God's not a thing, right? So he's excluded from that category of phenomena, object, thing, why not? So that leaves a conceptual space to affirm both the FMD and the core tenets of classical theism.
Yeah, and if I can add, there's this big tradition that will specifically argue like God is no entity, he's no thing, because he's rather the grounding of all things, right? And so if you're trying to ground all things, right, unless you're wanting to have some sort of like self-cause, something like that, then if we're grounding all things, we can't then ground it in a thing. And so God is no thing. And so the new Platonic tradition, for example, will actually literally call God no thing, right? Almost as if nothing, right? And, you know, there is this big new Platonic tradition that will even say God has no being. This kind of like apathetic theology. And if you look at various philosophers, Christian philosophers, even like Pseudo-Dionysius, he calls God a no thing, for example. But yet he says he's beyond being, right? So there's this kind of apophatic phrase here that we try to smooth out a little bit. And then ultimately, if you look at Christian thinkers like Catherine of Siena, like Jonathan Edwards, they talk about Jonathan Edwards actually affirmed impermanence and interdependence, but they actually talk about themselves as being empty, as really there being one existence, God. Athanasius, Saint Athanasius, person who fought for like the deity of Christ, the Council of Nicaea, for those who aren't familiar with who he is, you know, he talks about how the sun and moon, unless you take them all together, are empty in themselves. And so, yeah, we thought, well, there is this like apophatic Christian tradition that we think might give us some resources to go ahead and try to make some synthesis here.
Great.
If I might add, you even got in Descartes this sort of view that, strictly speaking, only God is a substance, is a primary substance, and other things that are considered substances are secondary substances. Why? Well, because from moment to moment, they depend entirely on the sustaining power of God to keep them in existence. Obviously, that's not how God works. God doesn't require anything outside of himself to sustain him in existence. But all things do. All things, in that sense, are empty of being. They're empty of own being. Again, elsewhere in the book, we kind of dialogue with the idea of existential inertia and argue why that's not going to work. Again, it's tied into this notion that all things are dependent on something else.
Right.
Not something else, strictly speaking, you know, it's something beyond thing that's a being.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Sorry to interrupt there.
I just wanted to clarify that little point.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks. I was curious in your presentation of the thesis at this point, because if I'm understanding you right, it's something like it's about the scope of the at what you calling FMD, right? That it applies to things, where a thing is a thing only if it bears properties. I was curious how your argument would go for Buddhist philosophers who are trope theorists, who deny that things actually properly bear properties, that there's just property particulars and bundles, and that's what it is to be a thing. Is that going to have to go differently, or are you thinking about those philosophers here too as well?
Do you want to take that? I have a quick reply, maybe.
Go ahead and reply, and then I'll add.
Okay. Well, in our definition, we leave undefined what it is to be a property, right? So what we could do is to accommodate this trope tradition, we could further define what it is to be a property. And then we might try to, there are various ways we might go were we to do that. But on one way, I can kind of see as property being just another no thing. I'm sorry, a trope being just another no thing. It wouldn't be any conflict if we were to further define our definition there. And maybe there's other ways it might be a conflict, but as long as there's one way to make a potential harmonization, then we've got things going the way we want them to go.
Yeah, so by trope theory, you mean kind of like almost like metaphysical Lego pieces, right? Where there is the same type of trope, but numerically distinct tropes. And so you have tropes like, on an apple trope, you have like sweet trope,
right,
and
right.
Red trope or green trope,
right.
and
right.
So
there's,
forth.
Exactly. There's no green that's shared among different,
that's right.
different instances. It's just a property particular that, yeah.
Exactly. And so even if it's a property particular, you could just kind of assume that within the language of property and still argue, as Eric was saying, so a thing just is that which has property particulars or something like that, and God has no property particulars, and so therefore, you know, he's still no thing.
Gotcha. Thanks. So maybe then we can go on and look at chapter 2 for the sake of time. There's a lot in here that we could talk about, but again, this is a sort of a highlight, and please add more if you want as we go. Chapter 2, Buddhist Objections to Classical Theism. And here we get into criticisms within Buddhism against the existence of a divine being. And of course, this would be in the Hindu context, broadly speaking, like Ishvara, the creator god, or other sorts of deities in that context. So that's not exactly the god of classical theism, which you note. And you take up three objections here: the argument from interaction, the objection that causes must resemble their effect, and the problem of evil. So there's three in the chapter. Maybe for the sake of time, we could focus on the objection that you take to be the strongest. So is there one of those that you think is the strongest? And then why do you think this objection fails?
Can I just real quickly mention something from the last chapter? Is that okay?
Please, absolutely.
Yeah, so actually two real quick things. First off, I was just going to say that some have argued that no Buddhist philosophers, what they mean like being simplicator. They don't just apply it to objects or things or phenomena. So we have we had a couple different responses, but one of them's looking at the Buddha and his kind of nonchalantness about metaphysics. And so whether you're wanting to argue that we have free will, or whether you're wanting to argue that we have a soul, or whatever, you know, the Buddha was simply kind of not interested in that because he didn't see that as relevant to realization. And so, you know, we quote where the Buddha says these things about this. But, you know, so ultimately, if you're like, well, you have more heavy duty emptiness, maybe like Abe's emptiness.
Abe. So, Abe.
Yeah, sorry, Abe. Or you have emptiness as just applied to kind of things or those that bear property particulars or properties. Which one's correct, right? Which metaphysical system is correct? Well, like the Buddha, we might just say that we don't need to be committed to the more heavier metaphysical thesis. In fact, we could even, what we're developing now is even a skillful means response to this issue where even if the heavier metaphysical thesis is what's meant, nonetheless, maybe that was said for a particular time, for a particular reason, because it wasn't helpful for realization. But now, right, things have changed a little bit. And so now we can kind of more minimize the heavier thesis. And then I was just going to say simply that some people will always ask about personal identity. And obviously Buddhism says, right, no enduring self. How do we make sense of that on theism? And that's going to come relevant to soteriology and the ethics chapters.
Yep.
And so Jonathan Edwards, we could take a cue from here. He thinks that, like, you know, we have these individual slices that are associated with each other, right? Tyler slice 1 p.m., Tyler slice 2 p.m., Tyler slice 3 p.m., right? So on and so forth. And so Jonathan Edwards, actually, what he thinks is that while each slice doesn't have like an enduring self, so to speak, an intrinsic identity, nonetheless, what God can do is he can take all of these slices, so to speak, and collectively give some sort of like external stamp on it and give it like a transtemporal identity with all the collections of these slices. And so whether or not you want to consider that a thing, since it's transtemporal and there's still no extrinsic, or there's still no intrinsic enduring self, so to speak. Anyway, that's just roughly a quick picture of how we paint those two issues. Sorry. I really wanted to make sure we hit on those topics.
Absolutely. Thank you. Anything you wanted to add to that, Eric?
Yeah. Just to double what Tyler was doing there. In the chapter two, when we're dealing with objections that are, I think, less central or more easily dealt with, the main thing I had a problem with our initial project was people who specifically denied the transcendent place, if you will, for the classical theist God to be. You know, again, Nishitani and Abe specifically look at this and say, no, you know, we're denying being and relative non-being, you know. We're affirming absolute nothingness, which is the transcendent of Platonic being and non-being. So where is place for classical theism there? And that I thought was the biggest problem for the project. And the solution that we mapped out was the one Tyler just iterated. So, So truthfully speaking, we deal with the most fundamental and most problematic objections in that first chapter.
Gotcha.
And then kind of do clean up in the second.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Okay. So as you're cleaning up then in the second chapter, which of the three objections that I mentioned do you think would be the strongest that you might want to take up for the listeners?
Yeah, so there's a resemblance objection, which basically says that the cause and effect have to resemble each other. And so if the effect is changeable, then the cause has to be changeable. That one doesn't get me. Doesn't move me too much. There's another one about like how impermanent or how something how can something that doesn't change interact with things that change? I think that one's more interesting. And then of course the problem of evil. You see in the literature God's kind of like mocked in reference to evil in the Buddhist literature. So there is a really interesting analogy that we draw from Eleanor Stump, where you know she talks about you have this kind of two-dimensional world, and from this two-dimensional world, you know, in the two-dimensional world as a two-dimensional creature, so to speak, you see the world differently than say if you were a three-dimensional creature. And maybe if you were a three-dimensional creature, you would be able to interact with the two-dimensional creatures all at once. Because maybe in their world, one dies and then the next one comes and then they die and the next one comes. But maybe from this three-dimensional point of view, you can see all of them at once. And so maybe somehow God, who transcends space and time, who's not a thing, not even a person like you and I are persons, maybe God can interact with us all at once, so to speak, kind of like this analogy that Eleanor Stump gives. Anyway, I think that's probably the most interesting one out of the three, but Eric might have a different view.
Yeah, I'd
have to agree. But yeah, to be honest, none of them that we deal with there are problematic as far as I'm concerned, but we're trying to think of problems that our readers, our audience might have, or things that we needed to address that what might be immediate flags, you know, why these sorts of objections do in fact fail.
Yeah, it was interesting. As I was reading, I mean, you can't possibly take up everything in a book, right? There's always choices. It kind of struck me that I'm sure you know Against a Hindu God, Parmal Patil's book on Ratnakirti, right? And I was just curious why you weren't engaging with like the design argument, the cosmological argument that Buddhists are critiquing in the Nyayaka, sort of the Nyaya arguments. Is it because Ratnakirti is a Yogacharan, you're not really engaging with them? Is it you just think kind of design arguments and cosmological arguments aren't really maybe the strongest? Just kind of curious what drew you to which objections? Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of both. We're trying to go with kind of a minimal Buddhist thesis here, right? We call it mere Buddhism after C.S. Lewis's mere Christianity. But also not so much looking at our arguments for God's existence good, but rather or not, are there arguments that disprove God's existence? So I guess you could kind of look at, well, hey, if they're objecting to these different arguments from design and cosmology, then maybe that's kind of like indirectly an argument for atheism, I guess, or at least agnosticism, right? Minimally. If there are no good arguments at the end of the day, something like that. But we were more interested in kind of like a positive case for classical theism being false. And so, yeah.
Great. So let's, again, in the sake of time, lots of stuff we can dig in, and please feel free to go back if there are things you want to pick up on as we move forward. Chapter three is where you pivot to contemporary objections to classical theism. And here you're focusing on, again, several objections. So first of all, for listeners, why would you turn to contemporary criticisms if you've already sort of taken up Buddhist claims and classical theism? What's the motivation for this chapter in your book?
Kind of like, all right, well, maybe this whole classical theism isn't really even intelligible, right? To talk about God being no thing, to talk about God being beyond being, right? Maybe this just isn't even like a coherent system. And so sure, classical theism and Buddhism, maybe you can make a a way where it kind of makes sense together. But I mean, the way that you kind of make it make sense is incoherent. And so we kind of wanted to provide further motivation for taking classical theism seriously as like a live project, so that chapter one and two won't be in vain.
Yeah, and to add to that, we wanted to have a sense of balance, right? There's a lot of people, I hope, who read this book, people in the classical theistic traditions, Christian traditions, Buddhist traditions, comparative philosophy traditions, and potentially a large segment of our audience might not know what we mean by classical theism. Or if they do know, they might have these immediate sort of objections to, as Tyler was saying, the coherence of it or the plausibility of it. So we wanted to look at the sorts of objections people might encounter nowadays and deal with those so that our book wouldn't be a non-starter to a large segment of the populace.
Yeah, classical theism has seen better days in analytic circles. Yeah. Classical theism isn't very popular. Divine simplicity isn't very popular. While for most of Christendom, these doctrines were very popular. Now, you know, from the advent of Plantinga and Swinburne and stuff, analytic philosophers of a religion typically aren't keen to defend kind of classical theism, at least most robustly defined.
Maybe we could talk about an argument in that chapter, the objection from temporal knowledge. That one caught my eye because it's also one that's discussed in classical Indian philosophy, as you probably know, in terms of, in Vajaspati Mishra and several other places engaging with this kind of criticism. God in the World's Arrangement has some nice readable translations of this argument. But maybe you can talk about it in the contemporary context. What's the argument, the objection from temporal knowledge against classical theism for contemporary folks?
Eric, do you want me to do this or do you want this?
Yeah, if you would,
that would be great. I've been talking a lot. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead and take this one.
Okay. I didn't want to be talking too much. Right. So here, I think the idea is that ultimately when it comes to problems about how do we talk about, say, that it's 1039 now, or say that kind of certain indexicals, or when it comes to understanding how God has knowledge and certain issues that are derived when we're talking about God having knowledge of certain truths, it seems to me that we're looking at God's knowledge too anthropomorphically, that we're still kind of characterizing God fundamentally as you and I. Again, a difference in degree, not kind. When we're talking about God's knowledge is identical to his power and his goodness. God's knowledge then can't be propositional. The idea being that whatever it means for God to have knowledge is going to be, it maps on to what, in some sense, to what we mean when we have knowledge, but it is going to be not the same thing. And so once you kind of get away from this anthropomorphic conceptions of what it means for God to have knowledge, we think that there's more room here to make sense of how God can have knowledge of certain truths that seem problematic, so to speak, especially if he's timeless. Eric, if you want to add anything to that.
No, I think that's good.
Yeah, it struck me that this is, again, like an interesting connection to how this problem is discussed in the Indian context, but it strikes me that it picks up on a theme that is happening throughout your book, which is about language and the sort of how we speak about God. Because one thing you might say is like, well, you're using this word knowledge, and I know what knowledge is in a human context. I come to know something at a certain time, and previously I didn't know that, or I can give some sort of account of the structure of an awareness event. I can talk about dispositional and standing knowledge, and you know, I can have all these things that I can cash out. But then when it comes to talk about how an eternal, simple being can have knowledge, it seems like our language slips. So maybe just an invitation to say a little bit more about how you're thinking about language, about God in this context.
Eric, you want to?
Yeah, sure. So that reminds me about Aquinas's general methodology, where you start from the created thing and work to the uncreated on his metaphysics, right? That we're aware of objects of experience, right? And we have to make sense of those with language, and we can do that for our purposes being the sorts of things that we are. And again, as you were saying, as we abstract from that more and get more rarefied in our concepts about, you know, uncaused cause, and we've got these abstract notions pretty well down in a sense, but when we start thinking about what it would be for God to know something, well, we're really kind of stepping outside our area, especially, if you will, right? It's hard to say that because we're already formulating everything in terms of concepts and terms that we understand that are inherently limiting, right? Where God is unlimited with respect to these things. So again, it's just really difficult to say with any certitude or any confidence necessarily what exactly God's mode of knowing is. But it's there, right? It has to be there because we have knowledge according to Aquinas and that kind of methodology, right? You can't have the created without the creator. You can't have the thing that is dependent on be completely independent of anything, right? At least within the Aquinas metaphysical picture. So yeah, it's difficult to talk about what can't be talked about, right? But we gotta try anyway, so.
Yeah, and so you know, there is a strong view on God being ineffable, not being able to know God's nature, so to speak, but still being able to talk about God either by way of negation or by way of analogy. And so that's where this is coming in, is saying, all right, guys, and we actually know, at least according to Eric and I's tradition, we're both Catholics. And so in our tradition, it even says that God is more dissimilar than similar when it comes to these things. Here it looks like that while we can't say exactly what God is, we can at least make analogies that are imperfect and will only get, you know, something that ultimately is kind of like a minimal framework to get our minds in the right kind of position for some sort of minimal understanding. And so that's the idea here.
If I might add one little thing that Tyler said reminded me, there's the Chinese sage who keeps pointing to the moon, getting you to have an experience of the moon, and the disciple keeps getting confused by the finger. Like, no, I'm pointing to the moon. I'm using my words and my gestures, my conventions to point to that. A lot of what the Aquinas picture is trying to do, I think, has this pointing to God. And that's what words are doing. That's what concepts are doing. It's pointing to the being of God, which we can't comprehend, but we can get enough of an idea of what's going on through language and through concepts and stuff to get properly acquainted with that.
Right. And of course, pointing to the moon is the title of one of Jay's many books in Buddhist philosophy. Yeah. So that's it. Yeah. So chapters 1 through 3 really focus on metaphysics. 4 turns to ethics. So you're not just looking at metaphysics, you're also looking at ethics. Of course, these are intertwined for Buddhists, and I think also for classical theists. So chapter 4 is titled Buddhist Ethics and Theistic Ethics, a Synthesis. And this might be overreading, but I thought it was interesting that you were arguing for a synthesis here. Is that something that's different than just saying the two positions are compatible? What's the project in chapter 4 in particular?
Yeah, it's to say that we can kind of create a coherent narrative, not just that there's kind of logical consistency that's disconnected, so to speak, but there is this nice narrative that we can tell about how these things fit together. And it's the same thing with the soteriology chapter as well. what we're doing is we're saying, all right, so depending on who you are, right, it depends on what you think the Buddhist ethics are, right? So whether you want to put it more in the virtue camp, or whether you want to put it in a more consequentialist camp, or whether you think that it's its own camp altogether, right, and it deserves its own name, so to speak, theists do the same exact thing. Some of theists are more consequentialist or virtue theorist. Obviously, you have divine command theorists, not too many of those in the Buddhist literature, but nonetheless, looking at the Eightfold Path and the right intention, right thoughts and that sort of thing, where there actually is a lot of commonality with like the Ten Commandments, and we can actually kind of break down the Ten Commandments in such a way where there is a lot of continuity there, and ultimately, God might give us commands so that we reach right realization, so that we, and this obviously gets in the soteriology chapter, but so that we act in a certain way. So he gives us commands so that we act a certain way that mimics something like the Eightfold Path, and that ultimately that's so that he gives us these commands and tells us to act in these ways so that we have right realization, so that we have nirvana, so to speak.
Eric, did you want to add anything to that?
So I think chapters 3 and 4 are in a way trying to flesh out some of the themes we introduced earlier on about double religious belonging with Habito and some of the others that, claim to be Buddhist and Christian, to a lot of people, especially a large segment of our audience, analytic philosophers, like, what the heck could that possibly be? here's a way it could go with respect to its ethics and the soteriology, giving a picture or a narrative, as Tyler was saying, of how this could actually go, or how it really is being done by certain people out there. And we didn't really have space to get into it, but there's all sorts of meditative traditions in Christian and Buddhist circles. And you can have Buddhist and Christian monks getting together and doing the same sorts of practices. They might frame what they're doing a little bit differently, obviously, but they're doing the same things. And it's like, detaching from self, or denying yourself, or putting yourself to death. You have that tradition in Christianity of dying to yourself daily and picking up your cross and following Christ. And you have that tradition of treating yourself as dead in Buddhism, and separating yourself from your transitory temporal desires for all sorts of things, that you're not to be identified with your lust or your whatever, and that you put those things aside. And there's all sorts of, again, Buddhist meditative practices that the Christian can take up, remaining a Christian, to distance themselves from patients of various kinds or whatever. It's hard to talk about all of that. Right. I think in those chapters we were trying to show how you can have a certain commensurability with certain core themes within Buddhism and Christianity, and that would make it maybe compelling for the reader to go look into more detail how that actually goes. I venture to say, if a typical Christian looks into some Buddhist meditative stuff or some other devotional kinds of literature, they'd see a lot more of these harmonization possibilities. Those two chapters are to hey, this can be done, go check it out.
And we do, it's worth pointing out that in the soteriological chapter we do take a kind of reductive view of karma, you can kind of take it in like a more heavy metaphysical way, where almost like you have a spiritual weighing what are those things called when it weighs
scales,
scale, like balance scales, there we go. Right, and there's like this cosmic balance scale, right? But you can also just take it in a more reductive sense, where since we're all connected together, whatever good stuff that leads to enlightenment that I kind of put into the world and I'm connected with others, it's going to help everyone as a whole sort of reach nirvana, and it's going to affect us in you know, positive ways. And ultimately, since we're all connected together, me doing positive stuff is going to ultimately help me, right? And we're kind of in a more reductive way, in the same way, if I do bad things, the reverse happens. So anyway, so on this, we do take a more reductive view of nirvana, but there are those in the literature who do that. So we don't feel too bad about that.
Yeah, let's maybe, since these two chapters work together, let me turn to the soteriology chapter as well. And this is titled Buddhist Soteriology and the God of Abraham. Real quick before we dive into that, I noticed now, as listeners probably will have, that we're now talking about Abrahamic traditions, not necessarily classical theism, because classical theism, as you frame it in the book, is something that at least you think is conceptually minimally consistent with Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, even if proponents of each of these traditions themselves might, individual ones, reject it, that you think logically it could be affirmed by all of these traditions. But chapter five, you're turning to the Abrahamic traditions, and you get into a little bit more specific detail about these traditions. Maybe first of all, you could say a little bit about why you did that at this juncture. Why are you turning to sort of Abrahamic traditions?
Yeah. So go ahead, Eric.
No, I was just going to say, just to limit things a bit. I mean, it's a short book. We can only do so much, right? So to make a comparison, you've got the three branches of Abraham and Christianity, Judaism, Islam. Well, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, however you want to lump them, right? We all look to Abraham. And then just to make the project manageable, we had to limit it in some sense.
So we thought, you know, we would just kind of take like, okay, who is our reader? And we're thinking, all right, if our reader is interested in classical theism, probably they'd be interested in one of the big three. Not necessarily. Conceptually, that's not necessary, obviously. But what are the kind of the big three traditions? And if these three traditions, which are more robust and endorse more doctrines and so forth, if we can make sense of salvation on these traditions, then surely we can make sense of salvation on a more minimal classical theist sort of approach.
And so in this chapter, you're basically, as I understand it, you unpack sort of your understanding of these three traditions in Buddhism in terms of what you're calling salvation or soteriology, the sort of the telos of these traditions. And you state your understanding of how these different approaches can be reconciled. And I wanted to read this little bit because I thought it was kind of the summary of your main point, and then kind of invite you to say a little bit about it. You're focusing here again on sort of Garfield's work in Buddhist ethics. So you say that the origin of suffering is found in confusing what is ultimate with what is not, and escaping suffering is achieved by a right orientation toward reality. We can then add that the Buddhist, who also identifies as a classical theist, can rightly believe that part of the process of how she escapes suffering is by way of God resurrecting her body once she dies. And in their resurrected body, she can focus on God and see ultimate reality for how it actually is. Classical theists refer to this as the beatific vision. So first of all, could you just unpack that a little bit for readers, what you're arguing for there?
Yeah, so for ultimate reality, God is ultimate reality. Right, there's like as Catherine of Siena, as Jonathan Edwards has stated, there's a sense in which God is and we are not. But sometimes, what do we do? we act like that we are existence, that we exist, all right, in this sense, and that we are ultimate, and that the things we're desiring are ultimate, and that just causes confusion and suffering, and so we need to have this kind of right mind, so to speak, this right mindset of no, we're empty, as these Christian scholars have thought. And when it comes to, again, kind of in keeping intact personal identity, I would just again appeal to kind of what we discussed earlier about this kind of transtemporal identity of the various slices, where extrinsically they're connected by God's kind of stamp of approval, so to speak, rather than some sort of enduring self that's intrinsic to the substance here. But Eric, feel free to add whatever you want to.
No, that sounds right to me. I wouldn't add much else.
Right. Yeah, so you anticipated my question, which was whether on your view, a classical theist should be like Inwagian, Van Inwagian kind of materialist, or if they should be a dualist like Richard Swinburne. Does this view commit you to any sort of positions about Christian understandings of personal identity over time, especially when you think about the resurrection, which plays a central role in this chapter?
I don't see any necessary connection there between what we're trying to defend and any particular understanding of what resurrection amounts to. Our view seems broad enough to take whatever route you might go there. But personally, we might have different ways we might go about that. I'm not sure. But again, we're trying to take a broad umbrella approach to this sort of question about personal identity. But I guess Edwards' view would rule out certain other views. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So it would Christian scholars, like if you read someone like N.T. Wright, or if you read someone like David Bentley Hart, they're going to have very different views on what it means to be resurrected. And so we didn't want to get too much into details here. Obtaining more baggage,
right?
But ultimately the idea is it's creating this kind of transtemporal identity, however that looks like, whatever that looks like, you can create models for it, I suppose, but that's another huge topic that you could spend lots of trees sacrificing.
Gotcha. Of course. So as long as for you, you can square the Buddhist doctrine of no self with the idea of some kind of resurrected personal continuity without there being an underlying enduring substantial self. That's all you're looking for, basically.
Right. Because again, the unity would be extrinsic to whatever the self is. It's not in what we're calling the self isn't an internal intrinsic unity. It's held together extrinsically by God's power.
Right. Yeah. And so the Nagarjunian claim that the ultimate truth is that there is no ultimate truth has a little kind of asterisk to it, which is except for God.
So we actually do have a footnote in there. Or it's not a footnote. Do we have footnotes or is it endnotes? I think it's endnotes.
Endnotes.
Yeah. Where we talk about like Nagarjuna's emptiness of emptiness being empty and that sort of thing. We're not arguing that particular kind of hardline view of Nagarjuna is compatible. We're going to pass on that. We're just again going for the more minimalistic sketch of the fundamental metaphysical views.
Jim. Well, let's, in the time that we have left, take up the two chapters on pluralism. There's part one and part two. Basically, my understanding is here, you take up John Hick, right, who's famous for his particular approach to religious pluralism that draws a lot on sort of the Kantian distinction between the noumenal and the phenomenal. And, he wants to argue that competing religious positions should, ceteris paribus, have equal weight, but that what that kind of amounts to is that they're all sort of equally non-veridical in some sort of sense. So chapter one, you focus on sort of Christian / classical theist. Actually, I think here Christian would be the better term, religious experience. And part two, the second chapter, takes up Buddhist religious experience and tries to think about religious pluralism in this context. Maybe take the two one at a time. What are you arguing for in the first part about Christian religious experiences? And in particular, you're focusing a lot on miracles, I believe.
Yeah,
Tyler, so
I'll take maybe the first one, and then you take the second one?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's this kind of objection where maybe we shouldn't endorse the metaphysical thesis of theism or Buddhism or whatever. Maybe we should just think that these are all kind of human constructs from our perspective of reality, trying to get at what ultimately is there, which can't, you know, be known in itself without mediation of concepts and ideas and our limited cognitive noetic structures or whatever. And so it's like, okay, well no, let's take why would you believe that? And so Hick gives various reasons as to why. For example, he doesn't think that various miracle claims regarding the resurrection of Christ or anything like that, and with specifically to Christianity, are going to fly, right? He thinks that they're not very good, and he thinks that ultimately, you know, all the kind of religious traditions are on the same playing field. And so what we're doing is first saying, well, one, you don't have to have, you know, if you're an externalist, you're not going to be required to have access to all the properties which confer warrants. You don't have to have arguments necessarily to back up your views. Aside from going that kind of route, we look at, okay, well, what is the evidence? Like, is Hick right? Is the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus not really good? And so we get into that and defend that, or at least give a kind of a brief, typical standard sketch of that literature, as well as talk about Fatima, and if there was kind of good reasons for thinking that maybe something supernatural occurred there. And
can you just really quickly explain what that is? Sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
Yeah.
For the listeners.
No. Basically, early in the 20th century, there were these three kids who were claiming that they were encountering Mary. They end up being taken in by the government and threatened, and things aren't going great, but nonetheless, they're still saying, yeah, we're encountering Mary, we're encountering Mary. And finally, they say, you know what, on a particular day, you know, something great's going to happen. Mary's going to show up, so to speak, and ends up attracting, like, I think at most, like 100,000 people, somewhere between 50 and 100,000 people show up, and they are expecting to see a miracle. What's going to happen? Well, vast majority of people report seeing the sun. So it was raining really hard. The rain goes away, right? The sun comes out and it starts to turn colors and spin on its axis and like look like it's heading toward Earth and kind of crash, and everyone starts freaking out, right? And you kind of have this mass experience of the sun blowing up the Earth. And then obviously that doesn't happen, thankfully, right? We're all still here. You know, so people will call this, you know, the miracle of Fatima. And so we look at kind of naturalistic explanations of that to see if they're any good, and ultimately find them wanting. And so like, no, maybe there really actually is like evidence that something supernatural occurred there. Maybe there really is evidence that the resurrection of Jesus occurred, that something supernatural occurred, and the naturalistic explanations aren't very good. And so we think Hick is wrong here, that we can look at individual religious experiences, whether it's because of externalism or because there's good miracles. You can look at miracle claims and at specific religious experiences as vertical, and not necessarily as just some attempt that's not in tune with reality and how it actually is. So we use this not so much to say prove Christianity or something like that. Rather, we're using this to talk about how the arguments for thinking that we can't know God, can't know divine reality, so to speak, are wanting. And this is going to open the doors up for us to take seriously the claims of both Christians and Buddhists when it comes to religious experiences. And that's where Eric, I'm sure, can jump in now.
Yeah, so in the second part of the pluralism 1-2 punch, we look at this notion, which I believe comes from Nishitani, the way he's fleshing it out, what it is to have shunyata experience. The idea of being interdependent and permanent and empty of all being that you get in the course of a Zazen meditative experience. There's all manner of Buddhists and Christians who participate in this sort of sitting Zazen type of meditation. And what I try to argue in that chapter, is that both Buddhists and Christians have and report having had what you can call sunyata experience, and that you can account for how that is possible on the truth of classical theism and on the truth of Buddhism together, right? So Buddhism is going to say, here's what's going on when you have a sunyata experience. You're experiencing what the Christian would call the far side of God, this impersonal ground of being. Again, the Buddhists isn't going to describe it that way. They're going to describe it in terms of lacking own being. But the Christian is going to describe it as this notion of all phenomena being empty in the same sense, right? So you're talking about the same thing, but was from a slightly different angle and giving it maybe a different metaphysical analysis, perhaps. But at the end of the day, you can make sense of this notion that you're describing the same experience enough. And that's the commonality between the Buddhist and the Christian. It would make this, again, this space possible for the Buddhist Christian.
Gotcha. So the experience of shunyata in the sort of Zen context is an experience, even though Buddhists would say the emptiness is applying to all phenomena and all things, there's a sense in which you're tapping into God. If you could just unpack that a little bit, I want to make sure
again, you're tapping into the emptiness of all phenomena, things, objects, according to analysis that we give in chapter one, right? Mm-hmm. That way of talking about things does not preclude or necessarily exclude the category of something beyond that. Some will say, no, there's nothing there, like Abe and Nagarjuna, right? But others will say, you know, maybe there is something out there beyond the phenomena. And maybe they're more open to the idea of there being something behind phenomena. That, again, you can't talk about very well, but you might be able to point to an experience and say, yeah, there's something, not literally a thing, but there's
and that's what's on the far side.
For the far side of the Trinity, the triune God, which would be what the Buddhists are experiencing, but not calling it that.
Gotcha. Did you want to add to that, Tyler, or?
No, that's
okay.
Fine.
All right, great. Well, I think that's a good place to leave things. There's a lot to unpack. Obviously, we haven't been able to nearly cover all the arguments that you take on in the book, but I think this gives listeners a sense of the overview, the structure, and they can go pick it up if they want to dig in more. I appreciate your time today. Last question for you. What are you working on now? You hint at it a little bit in the last chapter of the book. What's your project now?
Yeah, well, since this, we've published a paper in a Rutledge book on classical theism. It's an edited collection from Rob Koons and Jonathan Fuqua, where we kind of look at other kind of just Eastern traditions in general. So Shankara, we look at different kind of Taoist and Confucian approaches as well. And argue kind of like as a room for classical theism on all these traditions. And we kind of give a bare sketch of the book as well when we're talking about Buddhism. And we say, hey, listen, maybe the ineffable, maybe the Tao is, you know, consistent with God, or early Confucian beliefs about Shengdi, you know, that maybe that's consistent with classical theism. And so that might be of interest to your listeners. But I know currently I'm still thinking about Buddhism and classical theism In fact, we're working on a skillful means response, more thoroughly developed, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, and also kind of just continually kind of trying to see where we can draw synthesis from classical theism and these kind of Eastern Indian and Chinese philosophies. One thing I didn't mention, by the way, and this is something I discovered after the book was published, was that Keith Ward has a nice argument from some Buddhists where nirvana is not kind of just described as in a negative sort of way, or like this is sensation of pain ceasing or something like that. It's more like bliss, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe you might say pure consciousness, right? You can even get into the Indian traditions on kind of help kind of elucidate what bliss, you know, what we're talking about here, and that the if there's there might be a link there to talk about God maybe being bliss, maybe God being pure consciousness and that sort of thing. So anyway, there's more avenues to go, more avenues to investigate. So anyway, that's what I'm up to.
Great. Thanks, Eric.
Yeah. So like Tyler was saying, we're finishing up this skillful means upaya note paper, and we're tracking all of the book reviews that we're getting. There's been a lot of kind and interesting reviews, and seeing what the response to our book might be, you know, keeping our radar open there. Maybe we'll have an opportunity to take up a theme or two. We might elaborate or deal with an objection, perhaps, or we've got our radar up. And yeah, so that's the stuff that I've been working on that's relevant to our project here in the book.
Great, thanks. Well, look forward to seeing more work from you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today about your book.
Thanks.
Thank you.